Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. Salon at 615 is recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Well, thanks for showing up. I know that there's some people behind also, so hello to you too. I'm very happy to be here in this crazy book tour. I'm doing like 14 cities in 20 days or something like that. And I'm a little sick, so there will be no hugging. Is there any Hispanics here? This should be in Spanish. Okay, para los latinos, no les puedo dar besos, porque estoy muy resfriada. ¿Ah? No. Okay. I'm going around the country presenting this new book, Maya's Notebook. And it's a very different book from all my other books. Because I've been writing historical novels for a long time. And this is a departure in the sense that it's very contemporary. Well, it was contemporary when I wrote it in 2010. But my usual translator, Margaret Peden, is 84. And this is the story of a 19-year-old girl from Berkeley. And so she said, I just can't get the voice. And she felt very tired. She had had an aneurysm. So she decided that she was not going to continue working. So we found another translator, but that took some time. And then she took a year to translate. So now this book is a historical novel too. But when I wrote it in 2010, the story happens in 2009, it was really contemporary. And why did I write about a 19-year-old girl from Berkeley, so different from me? I mean, first of all, she looks Scandinavian. She has long legs. She's blonde. Because at the time, when I was writing the book, I was surrounded by teenagers. My three grandchildren were teenagers and all their friends. And I have my husband's granddaughter and the two children of my assistant who are like my grandchildren too. So all this testosterone and estrogen was floating in the atmosphere. And this craziness, because teenage years are crazy years. Everything has developed except the frontal lobe, so they can't think. And so I was writing about them, really, like a summary of all of them together. But one of the main inspirations was my youngest granddaughter, called Nicole, who is absolutely adorable. But at 15, she had the boyfriend from hell. She looked like Jennifer Lopez, and she had a brain of an 8-year-old. My son lost all his hair trying to protect her. I think he installed a GPS in her shoes or someplace so that he could follow her around because he was crazy. Now she's 18, she's studying in NYU, she's athletic, she's beautiful, she has a wonderful boyfriend, everything is fine, the frontal lobe developed. So that is the story of Maya. Maya is a girl who has been raised by her grandparents, and she adores her grandfather, also the grandmother. The grandfather is her step-grandfather, her grandmother's second husband. And he's this large, wonderful African-American astronomer from the university in Berkeley. And the wife, the Nini, the grandmother, is a mean, short Chilean woman. Whom do you think is the inspiration for that one? And so the grandmother is the one who will slap the kid around, but also she could give her life for her. I've been slapping my kids around all the time. It doesn't hurt them at all. I remember when Andrea was like 4, she would take out her seatbelt, and I slapped her. She said, I'm going to call 911. I slapped her again. That was it. Never again. So Maya adores her grandfather, gets along with her grandmother, and the grandfather develops pancreatic cancer when the girl is 16 and he dies. The grandmother goes into an awful depression, and the girl finds herself at 16 abandoned because she doesn't have parents to speak of. And then she starts getting in trouble, first with the wrong friends at school, then petty theft, some drugs, alcohol, more. She gets deeper and deeper in trouble. And when she becomes uncontrollable, she's sent to a special school and she runs away and she ends up in Las Vegas, where she's recruited by a gang of criminals who are drug dealers and dealers of all kinds of stuff. And without even knowing, she becomes addicted and involved in a federal crime. She doesn't know what she's doing. Eventually, she's running away from everybody. She's hiding. She's homeless. And she's terribly sick. And the thugs are after her because they think she knows where some money has been hidden. And at that point, the grandmother finds her. And the grandmother sends her into hiding in a small island in the southern part of Chile. In the southern part of Chile, there's an archipelago called Chiloé. And it has many, many islands. A main big island and many small islands. Some of them are inhabited and some are not. And it's a wonderful, beautiful place with a lousy weather. According to Darwin, it's the worst weather in the world, but that's an exaggeration. It's very cold and stormy in winter, and the winter is long, but the summers and the springs are just phenomenal. And I know the place very well, so I wanted to find a place that would be a contrast to Las Vegas. Las Vegas is, I don't know if many of you must have been there. It's a very popular place, apparently. I hate it. And it's, first of all, it's a city, artificial city, born in the desert. And everything has to be brought. It's all glitter, entertainment, noise, gambling, money, prostitution, all kinds of vices, all the drugs in the world that you want to find, corrupt police, everything you find there. So I wanted something that would be a contrast to that, and a place where Maya could find silence. We live in the noise, especially the teenagers. That's what appalled me about my grandchildren. They're all the time connected to earphones, all the time connected to the phone. It's their lifeline. I mean, if the phone rings, they can be making love and they interrupt. Because they have to know who is the new person in Facebook. Immediately, it can't wait. That has become an addiction. And so Maya, who is all the time in this entertainment thing and connected all the time, in the island, because she's hiding, she cannot use the internet, she cannot use email, she cannot use Facebook, nothing. She has the possibility, because the technology exists in Chiloé when there is a signal, but she can't use it. And for the first time in her life, she has time to reflect, to see what she has done in the past, to write it down in a notebook, to see what's going on around her, to get out of herself and establish a relationship with a few people that live in the island, especially with the old man who has taken her in. She doesn't know why this man, who is a writer, a secluded, a hermit, why would he take her in? And that is part of the mystery of the book, and I'm not going to tell you why. But when she tries to uncover the history of this man who lives in this wooden house without doors, she starts uncovering the secrets of Chile's past, of the history of Chile. Chile, in 1973, we had a military coup, and we had 17 years of dictatorship in Chile, military dictatorship. And it was brutal. Many, many people left the country, many were arrested, many disappeared, many were killed. And this is a terrible wound in our past, and people don't talk about it much. Those who were victims of the repression are usually my generation, and nobody pays any attention to them anymore. The young people, it's not their story. They were not even born when it happened. Why would they care? And the people who supported the dictatorship know that atrocities were committed. Some of them may be ashamed of what happened, but many justify it because they say, well, it was a war against communism. So everything is justified with that title. And so she starts uncovering all these things and gets involved. First, her curiosity, she gets out of herself. It's not about her anymore. It's about everybody around her. And in the island, she learns the first law of nature, which is the law of reciprocity. You have to give as much as you take, which she had never thought about. She had been a taker. She had received unconditional love. She had had a good life. She had received and received and had never given anything back. And this is the time to give back, because otherwise she would not be embraced by this community. And so she starts to change. And in this year in the island, her frontal lobe develops, like in Nicole. And by the time the book finishes, she's 19, and she's another person. So it's a story of growing up, a coming of age story, also part a crime novel, part a family novel, because I always write about family. That's what interests me the most, the relationships. And families are all crazy. Don't think that only your family is crazy. All are crazy. Some families look normal because they keep the secrets. So I will read for around 10 minutes, and then I can take questions. Because they are recording, and because they want to hear in the back, behind this wall, we will pass around a microphone so that you talk to the microphone, okay? And please, the people who are in charge of the house, when we start the questions, turn on the light in the house so that I can see, okay? See the people. Here, Maya is still in Vegas. She's in the pit of hell. She is by now completely homeless, very sick, and she's addicted. She has been using all kinds of stuff. The same day of my encounter with Officer Arana, a couple of hours later, Joe Martin and Chino finally caught up with me. I didn't see the frightful black van, and I didn't sense the thugs approaching until they were right on top of me, because I'd spent the $10 Arana gave me on drugs, and I was high. They forced me into a vehicle while I screamed and kicked in desperation. Some people stopped, but no one interceded. Who was going to mess with two dangerous-looking bullies and a hysterical homeless girl? I tried to jump out of the van while it was moving, but Joe Martin paralyzed me with a punch in the neck. They took me back to the building I knew all too well, Brandon Lima's den of drug addicts and criminals. The rude things daubed on the wall, the garbage and broken glass had multiplied, and it smelled of excrement. They dragged me up to the apartment on the third floor. "Now you're going to sing, you slut," Joe Martin threatened me, an inch from my face, squeezing my breasts with his ape-like hands. "You are going to tell us where Lehman hid the money, or I'll break every bone in your body, one at a time." At that instant, Chino's cell phone rang. He talked for a couple of seconds and then told Joe Martin that they had orders to get going. They were waiting for them. They gagged me with a rag in my mouth and adhesive tape, threw me down on one of the mattresses, tied my ankles together and my wrists with an electric cord, and then tied them to each other so that I was bent backwards. They left, after warning me again what they'd do to me when they got back. And I was left alone, unable to scream or move, the cord cutting into my ankles and wrists, my neck sore where they'd hit me, suffocating from the rag in my mouth, terrified at what was going to happen to me at the hands of those murderers, and because the effects of the alcohol and drugs were beginning to wear off. I tried not to vomit, though I was gagging and could feel it coming up my throat. I thought I would die of asphyxiation. How long was I on that mattress? It's impossible to know with certainty, but it felt to me like several days, although it could have been less than an hour. Very soon I began to tremble violently and to bite the rag, now soaked with saliva. With every shudder, the wire dug deeper into my skin. The fear and the pain kept me from thinking. I was running out of air, and I started to pray for Joe Martin and Chino to return so I could tell them everything I knew, take them to BD to see if they could shoot those locks off And if they then shot me in the head, that would be at least preferable to being tortured to death like an animal. I didn't care about the damn money. Now, months later, in this little island of Chiloé, with a calm of distance, I understand that was their way of making me confess. They didn't have to break my bones. The torment of withdrawal was enough. Outside, the sun had set, no light filtering between the boards over the windows, and inside, the darkness was total. Meanwhile, I, sicker and sicker, kept praying the murderers would come back. But it wasn't Joe Martin or Chino who turned on the light and leaned over me. It was Freddy, my little friend, so skinny and demented that for a moment I didn't recognize him. "Shit, girl, fuck, fuck," he was mumbling as he tried to get the gag off my mouth with a trembling hand. He finally got the rag out, and I could take an immense breath and fill my lungs up with air, retching and coughing. "Freddy, Freddy, sweet Freddy." He couldn't get me untied. He only had one hand and was missing two fingers on the other one. He never recovered the use of it entirely after that beating. He went to get a knife from the kitchen and started fighting with the electric cord until he managed to cut it and, after eternal minutes, free me. My ankles and wrists were bleeding, but I didn't notice until later. In those moments, I was overcome by the anguish of withdrawal. Finding my next hit was the only thing that mattered to me. It was useless to try to stand up, as I was shaken by convulsions and spasms, with no control over my extremities. "You have to get out of here, girl," the boy was repeating like a litany. Freddy went to the kitchen again and came back with a pipe, a blowtorch, and a handful of crack. He lit it and put it in my mouth. I inhaled deeply, and that gave me back a bit of strength. "How are we going to get out of here, Freddy?" I murmured. My teeth were chattering. "Walking is the only way. Stand up, girl," he answered. And we walked out the simplest way, through the front door. We slipped down the stairs in the darkness, glued to the wall, him holding me up by the waist, me leaning on his shoulders. He was so small, but his brave heart more than made up for his fragility. We walked a few blocks in the shadow of the houses, getting away from the building. Freddy tried to stop several taxis, but when they saw us, they didn't stop. We must have been a deplorable spectacle. He took me to a bus stop, and we got on the first one that came without noticing where it was going or paying any attention to the expressions of repugnance on the faces of the passengers or the driver's glances in the rearview mirror. I was disheveled, smelled of piss, had smears of blood on my arms and shoes. We got out at the last stop, where Freddy took me to a public washroom, and I cleaned myself the best I could, which wasn't much. And then we got on another bus, and then another, and we went around and around Las Vegas for hours to shake the thugs off. At last, Freddy took me to a black neighborhood where I had never been. The badly lit streets were empty at this time of night, lined with humble working-class houses, porches with wicker chairs, yards full of junk and old cars. After that terrible beating that Freddy had taken for going into a neighborhood he didn't belong in, it took a lot of courage to take me there. But he didn't seem worried, as if he'd walked down these streets many times. We arrived at a house no different from all the rest, and Freddy rang the bell several times, insistently. Finally, we heard a thundering voice. "Who's got the nerve to bother us so late?" The porch light came on, the door opened a few inches, and an eye inspected us. "Praise the Lord, is that you, Freddy?" It was Olympia Pettiford in a plush pink bathrobe, the nurse who had taken care of Freddy in the hospital when he got beaten up, the gentle giant, the Madonna of the defenseless, the splendid woman who ran her own church of the widows for Jesus. Olympia opened her door wide and hugged me in her African goddess's embrace. Poor girl, poor little girl. She carried me to the sofa of her living room and laid me down there with the tenderness of a mother with a newborn baby. Thank you. Thanks. Good. Now I can see you. This is like the beginning of Maya's recovery, because in that house of Olympia Pettiford, she will be found by the grandmother and sent away. Now, some people have asked me about the research for this book, because there are many scenarios in the book. Berkeley, Las Vegas, Chiloé, etc., Oregon. And all the part about addiction, I didn't have to research it. Unfortunately, it happens in my family. In my husband's family, my stepchildren, the three stepchildren, are addicted. And two of them have already died of drug-related causes. The youngest one died a month ago. And Jennifer, the girl, died when she was 28. So I have seen very close what addiction does to the person, to the victim, because it's an illness, and to everybody around them. So that part I did not have to research, just find out what were the new drugs in the street at that moment, because they change all the time. And the rest, it was easy to research, because if I had been able to research about the slave revolt in Haiti 200 years ago, I can research about Las Vegas. It's not that hard. So if you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get you a microphone. There's the gentleman over there.
There you go. There's a myth that when you write, that there's a special date in January that you start books?
Yeah.
And I wonder if this is how you write, if it's changed over the years.
No, it has not changed.
And could you tell me about the could you tell us about the myth?
I started my first book on January 8th because I was living in Venezuela at the time, 1981. And my grandfather was dying in Chile. I was a political refugee. I could not go back. So I started a letter for my grandfather. That, of course, he died before he was able to read it. But I kept on writing, and that letter became The House of the Spirits, my first book. And it was a successful book, because sometimes books are successful and nobody can tell you why or which book is going to be successful. But it happened to my book. And it was such a successful book that when I started my second book, I thought, just for Kabbalah, for luck, I'll start on January 8th. And then the third book, I have to start on January 8th because the second one had been successful too. So I kept on, and I have kept the date. And I'm sure that if I change the date, my book will be a flop. So I'm just very disciplined, and on January 7th, I have everything ready. And on January 8th, no matter what, I will be there writing. Not every year, because sometimes I have not finished the book the previous year. I have written 20 books in 30 years. So that's like a year and a half per book, more or less, which I think is a pretty good record. And if my writing has changed over the years, that was the other question. Well, of course I have changed. So if I have changed and the world has changed, the writing has changed, but the process has not. I always confront the first moment of starting a book and the first few weeks with terror, because I think that there's a moment in when I sort of start channeling the characters. I hear their voices. I'm not in control anymore. I have a vague idea of where I'm going, but I let the book flow. That's the moment when the book is happening. Before that, I'm forcing it, and it doesn't happen. It's like dancing. When you're counting the steps, you're not dancing. But when you just let the music get inside and it carries you along, well, then you're dancing. So it's the same with writing. That process has not changed. There's a gentleman here with a red shirt.
Hi, Isabel. I'm from Panama, and we also had a dictatorship there. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you think that it's important that keep telling the new generations about how these things affect a country. So, yeah. Because there's a one way or another, you always talk about it in your books.
For me, if of course I will not write about the Chilean dictatorship in a book about slavery in Haiti, but if the book allows it, I make a reference. I think it's important to keep the memory of the past alive, not only because for a dictatorship, just anything. Jewish people have been very successful in keeping the Holocaust alive. We all know what the Holocaust was, and everybody in the world knows, and all the generations born after the people who were victims of the Holocaust will know and will remember, and the world will try that, do their best so that it won't happen again. In Chile, we have put everything under the rug. We don't want to hear about it. But I was in Chile when it was the anniversary of 30 years of the dictatorship, and everything was in the news. There were documentaries and photographic exhibits, and there was all kinds of information. It was always in the news for a year. So there's no one in Chile who can deny that those things happened. They can justify them, but they did happen. Yes, the lady there.
Hi, I'm Juanita. I've been following you all my life. Okay, don't laugh at my question. But as a good Latina girl...
Can you get the mic?
Oh, as a good Latina girl in her house, I always watch their novelas. And not so long ago, Doña Bárbara turned into another novela,
yeah,
which is how I heard about it. Do you think you're going to try to put in your books and work with, like, Telemundo to make a novela? Yeah.
She's talking about
it. I would love Los Cuentos de la Luna, at least one of them, to be another novela.
Well, when I lived in Venezuela and in Chile, the telenovela, I mean, the... How do you call it? Soap opera. The soap opera was more important than anybody's life. Your family could be in the most horrible distress, but what happened to the people in the telenovela was more important. If there was a wedding in the telenovela, we all celebrated and we all ate cake, and it was just so important. I remember that the one telenovela that was wonderful, it was a woman who, a lame woman, she was limping. But she was, of course, beautiful with false eyelashes and whatever, but she was limping. And the guy was a butcher, very unusual, because in the telenovelas, first of all, nobody works. And then everybody looks like a model. So this is a very, very unusual one. And after 300 days or 300 nights, finally, there was a kiss. And of all the kisses I have received in 70 years, that is the most important kiss of all. The one that I saw in the telenovela. They kissed for, I think it was 1 minute and 30 seconds. People were counting. I mean, we were counting. And it lasted forever. And then it was repeated in the news that evening because everybody was so fascinated that finally they got together that it was repeated in the news. Then it was repeated again in the news the next day. And then they had to repeat the whole thing again in the evening, the whole episode of that night. So I got to see the kid. And then it won an award at the end of the year as the scene of most impact of the year. So I saw it 5 times. It's the most important kiss of my life, of course. When often my books are, I mean, people approach me to make a movie or a musical or different things with my books. And now there is an idea of doing a TV series with one of my books, with Inés of My Soul. And because it's the history of Chile, it's a very difficult thing to do because those historical series are very expensive. But they are trying to get the money together and do Inés of My Soul. And there is... On the 19th of May, that is in 2 weeks and a half, or in 2 weeks, There's an opera with one of the stories of Eva Luna in Los Angeles, directed by Plácido Domingo. And the story is called Revenge, but they changed the name and they called it Dulce Rosa. So if you Google Dulce Rosa, you will see all the stuff about the opera. Really interesting. They changed the ending though. They told me I've heard this before, because when they have made movies of my books, it's the same thing. They don't like open endings. It has to have closure of some kind. And in my story, there is a vague ending in which the girl commits suicide, and we don't know why she killed herself. If she killed herself to punish the guy she was in love with, because she had promised her father that she would take revenge. There are like four reasons, I don't remember them now, why she could have done it. That doesn't work in an opera. It has to be really clear. So they changed it, but it's okay. If Plácido Domingo is there, fine, fine. Can do whatever he wants. Let me see over there. The lady there. And then we'll go over here.
It's an honor to be here and get to know you. I was pregnant with my son who is here. Oh. Also, when I read The House of the Spirit, my husband said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "I'm pregnant and I'm reading Isabel Allende."
And I couldn't. Is your son normal?
I kept asking him, "Philip, Philip,
where's Philip? Philip, where are you?" He's your son?
Yes.
My God, he looks like your husband.
And in Brazil, everybody loves you. And I have a friend that comes here to visit, every 2 years. She bring your book to me in Portuguese. It's easier for me to read. And I'd like to ask one question. You are such a strong woman with this stronger personality. Who is your role model, besides your mom, of course, as
my
a woman?
Model. You know, I can't give you the name of someone famous, but I have many, many role models. I have a foundation that works empowering women and girls. And you cannot imagine the people I get to meet. People who survive the most horrible circumstances, and they get back on their feet, and they go out there and become leaders in the community. Those are my heroes. People who have nothing and make something of their lives. Who have been on the floor I don't know how many times, and every time they get back on their feet. So those are my heroes. And some people who dedicate their lives to helping other people for no reason at all except a great heart. And I will give you one example. A woman called Olga Murray that you probably have never heard of. She is a tiny 86-year-old lady with tennis shoes. When she was 60, she was a widow, she went to Nepal. She fell up in the mountains trekking and broke a leg. And the poor Sherpa had to carry her on his back all the way to the next village, where they sort of mended her a little bit. And while she was there, she realized that there was a festival going on, and people were putting on their best clothes and preparing food, and there were buses coming from the cities to the villages to buy girls, little girls, that the fathers sold into domestic servitude. So they would buy little girls that were 7, 8 years old, sometimes younger. And they would go in the buses, and in the cities, they would be sold to families who would have them as servants for 10, 15 years, until they probably got pregnant or ill or died. So when she saw that, and she realized that if she spent the few dollars she had trying to buy a girl, and that was the equivalent of, let's say, $50, she was not going to save the girl, because the parents would sell her again to another agent, because they didn't have money to support them. And so she came back to the United States, created a foundation somehow with her friends at the beginning, and now it's a very big foundation. And she went back to Nepal, and she has saved from domestic bondage 12,000 girls. Every year, Olga's girls, the day of the festival, go out in the streets, and they set up, they do plays, because most people can't read. So they do plays, they talk on the radio, they go on television, trying to save their sisters from the same fate. And it has been such an incredible campaign that the government got involved. And it is forbidden. I mean, the practice has been forbidden. It still happens under the table. But the practice has been forbidden, and 12,000 girls have been saved. And that's the action of just one little woman. So she's my hero, among many others. She had a question here, this lady.
First, I just want to say it's such a huge pleasure to see you here.
Thank you.
One of my favorites, so it's an honor. And I think that in your way of always having such strong women, you are making a huge difference yourself every day in so many lives. So thank you. And then one of my favorite stories is The Island Beneath the Sea, and please tell me you're going to continue those stories.
Island Beneath the Sea is the book I was talking about that is the story of the slave revolt in Haiti. I wasn't planning to write that book. I wanted to write about the pirates of the Caribbean. And this is, yeah. Well, the movies were much better than whatever I could have written. But when I wrote Zorro, I needed to stop Zorro on the way back to California, so I had him kidnapped by pirates of the Caribbean. So I had to research about the pirates. And I realized that it was one of the very first really democratic societies in the world. They had a sort of social network to help each other. The captains were elected, and they had power only on the ship. On land, they were just equal to everybody else. There was equality, and there was justice, very, very simple justice. And people were taken care of. If you were injured, if you were old, or a widow, or children, you would always be taken care of because part of the bounty would go to protect the weak. It was a very interesting society. And the center was Barataria, this island in front of New Orleans. And when the Americans came and they wanted the head of the Lafitte brothers and whatever, and they were going to invade the island, in 24 hours, in one day, everybody disappeared. Everybody melted into the fog. Now, where did those pirates go? What happened to the Lafitte brothers? Where did they end up their lives? What happened to the treasures that supposedly they had, and the ships and everything else? They disappeared. I mean, if that's not magical realism, what is? So I thought, this is a wonderful book. But when I went to New Orleans to research for the book, I realized that the flavor of New Orleans, the French flavor, the cuisine, the voodoo, the music, came from 10,000 colonialists, French colonialists, that escaped from Haiti in one year, in 1800. And they escaped because of the revolt, and they were burning all the plantations, and they went to New Orleans, which was a town of 3,000 people. So it changed completely, dramatically. Many of those colonialists came with their domestic slaves. And so there was soon a class of empowered free people of color in New Orleans that gave also a flavor, very special flavor to the city. So then I researched about the island and what had happened, because it was more interesting, the story from where those 10,000 refugees came, than the story of the pirates of the Caribbean. But it was a complicated story to research because everything was changing in Europe at the time. It was after the French Revolution. Everything was changing. And slavery had been abolished in France, but not in the colony. So it was a very unfair situation. And so that's how that book came to be. And I'm glad I wrote it, because when I published the book, I got contacted by abolitionist movements. There are abolitionist movements in the world today, because there are more slaves today than ever before in history. There are 27 million slaves that have been counted, and innumerable more that have not been counted. And they are usually they're usually workers, because we think of slavery as girls that are kidnapped into brothels in Cambodia. Well, that's a minimal part. Most of it is labor. People who live in slavery and work for nothing and are treated like slaves today. And human trafficking is a huge business. Huge. Another question, a more happy question. Yes, the guy there with the tie.
First, Miss Alinda, it's a pleasure to see you tonight. I've been waiting for this for a few months, and I am also a great fan of yours. And I followed a lot of the themes of your books about the treatment of women and oppression, and even in Zorro, how there's the missions of California and Padre Mendoza. And I've also noticed how you've used a lot of historical figures in your books, like Three-Fingered Jack and and the Lafitte brothers. And in the missions, Padre Mendoza and Zorro was really a good guy, but in real life, there was supposedly a lot of mistreatment among the natives, and like when Father Sarah founded the missions. And just what I was getting to is two things. Is have you ever considered using Father Junipero Serra as one of your figures? And also, is what is your opinion on him, too, as if he was really like Padre Mendoza, or if he was more into keeping them into slavery, the natives into slavery?
Junipero Serra?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Junipero Serra was one of the many priests who founded the missions in California. And he has a bad reputation, the poor guy. I'm sure he had the best intention in the world. He was saving souls, but he will save souls with a whip. And I didn't want to put a character like that in the book. Padre Mendoza protects the Indians in his own way, because he also enslaves them, doesn't allow them to get out of the mission. So it's a very mixed thing. And we have to look at these things in the perspective of history. When we judge things with our modern eyes, everything looks awful. But if you, I think, what kind of person would I have been if I would be the wife of a plantation owner in Haiti in 1800? How would I think? Would I think like a modern person today that lives in San Francisco? No. So the environment, the circumstances, the time where we live also has a lot to do with it. So we can't judge Junipero Serra with the eyes of a modern person. There's a hand here and another one there. Okay, so let's begin here and then there. It's not the same person, is it? No. Yeah. We should have two microphones.
Para mí es un gran honor verla porque yo la escuchaba. I'm sorry, I don't know why I'm speaking Spanish.
Yeah, try to say it in English so I don't have to translate.
Okay. I'm very pleased to see you finally. I used to read some of your magazines in Chile back when you used to write in Paula, mm-hmm. back in the
60s. Another life.
Yes. Yeah. So I was pretty young back then.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
And you were too. But I'm from Chile, and I've been reading all your books, and every time I pick one, I don't stop until I finish. And the one I identify with is Mi País Inventado, because this something happened when immigrants come to this country. We get detached to our own, and then we finally don't identify with the one we left behind, and then mm-hmm. our new country. And there is a lot of women, not just from the ones that come here from Chile, but from other countries.
What is the question?
The question is that, I'm sorry, I went off my mind, you know. I have a senior moment. My question is, when in life, how young were you when you realized that you were going to be a writer? How did you become a writer?
Oh, I became a writer because it was not my first option, actually. I became a writer in Venezuela because I couldn't be a journalist. I had been a journalist in Chile, and when I left and I started living in Venezuela, I couldn't get a job. I did all sorts of odd jobs, ended up administering a school, and out of desperation, because I had all these stories inside, I ended up writing this letter for my grandfather that became a book. So I found my voice very late in my life when I was 40, and when the book was published, or when I finished the book, I thought it was a one deal, that it would never happen again, that it was like something that I had put in that book, everything I knew, my family, my country, my past, the military coup, my grandfather, the anecdotes of the family. I left nothing out, to the point that my editor at the time, Lee Gerner, said, "You have like 3 books here. Don't be so generous." So I thought, yeah, that's it. I'm never going to be able to write anything else. But when I sent the book to Spain to an agent after some time, when I discovered that literary agents exist, I sent her a book to this woman in Barcelona, Carmen Balcells. And she said, "I'll take your book. I will have it published. Don't worry about it. And it's a good book, but everybody can write a good first book because it's the story of their lives. The writer is proven in the second book." So immediately I started writing. Oh no, I waited until January 8th, of course. And I started writing the second book. But I didn't find my voice until late in my life. There, over there.
We just finished reading La Ciudad de las Bestias in our Spanish class, and I was wondering if you had any plans on writing any more literature that's specifically geared to the youth or younger generation.
Well, I wrote that trilogy. La Ciudad de las Bestias, the City of Beasts, is the first of a trilogy. The second one is, I forgot, Kingdom of the Golden Dragon. And the other one is Forest of the Pygmies. And then I wrote Zorro, which is, could also be for young adults. And this book, Maya, is not meant for young adults because it's a very raw book. And many parents will object that their children would read this. But I think the kids will read it because it's about them and the things that can happen to them. They're exposed to so much stuff. And then you are all kids here. You know that everything is available. So I think they will read it. Now, writing with an audience in mind, with a readership in mind, writing for young adults or for little kids, it's boring because you're limited. First of all, you're limited by certain rules that the editors have decided. For example, in a young adult book, you don't talk about sex. All the violence you want, that's fine. No sex. How can you write a book without sex? Otherwise, it would be... What are you going to write about? So I try to think of my readership as people who love to read, and they can be any age or any gender. Here's another question. I will take 3 more questions.
Two questions then. I understand that you were in Peru. You were born in Peru. I was born in Cusco, Peru. And then also what I'd like to know is what you consider to be your legacy to the world.
My legacy?
Yes.
Oh, God. First, I was born in Peru because my parents were diplomats in Peru. But the children of diplomats that are born abroad, if you register them in the consulate, they have the nationality of the parents. So I'm Chilean by nationality. Well, now I am American. But I was born in Peru by chance because my parents were there. My mother married the wrong man and ended up in Peru. And not because there's nothing wrong with Peru, there was something wrong with my father. And so when my mother was expecting my youngest brother, my mother was married for 4 years and had 3 kids. Fertility runs rampant in my family. thank God I was born, I became an adult when the pill was invented. Otherwise, I would have, I don't know, 24 kids. So, and the other question about legacy. Some time ago, I was invited to the Melk Abbey in Vienna. It's close to Vienna. It's not in Vienna. It's close to Vienna. They flew me there in a helicopter because there was a meeting of religious leaders from the world. The Dalai Lama was there, Orthodox priests, Jewish rabbis, Catholic priests, bishops, you name it, all men. And the audience was mostly male too. I have no idea why they invited me to be the keynote speaker in such an event. It was the last, I wasn't meant to be there. In any case, the theme of the day was your legacy. And the participants had been invited to walk in the gardens, in the magnificent gardens of this old abbey, and think about their obituary and about their legacy to the world. That was like the assignment. And then I fly in a helicopter, land in front of the Dalai Lama without any preparation, and I have to speak. And they tell me, it's about legacy, it's about legacy. About what? Legacy. So I get up there and I said, look, gentlemen, legacy is a penis word. Women don't use the term legacy. We know that we are going to die and we will be ashes and no one will remember us. It's only men that want to tie for the future their fortune, their name, their dynasty. That's crazy. That is completely crazy. How many people do we know that we remember after they are dead? Only the family, the close family, and the rest a few historical figures, and that's it. So legacy, my dear, I know that no one will remember me after my son dies. My grandchildren will not remember me. So, no legacy. and by the way, there is something else that is important. People think that because I write books, that's a legacy. I've been touring and reading, of course, in the plane. The only thing you can do is read. So I was reading a book called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, a terrible title, by, what's the name of the guy, Laurie? Nathan Engelander. Wonderful writer. You have to read him. Wonderful writer. He has one story in there called The Reader. I photocopied the story, and this will be my Bible, this story. It's the story of a best-selling author who goes around touring, etc. 10 years later, he writes another book, and he goes around in his car, gets to the bookstore, and there's nobody there. He can't even get a cup of coffee because the barista is not there. So someone gives him a Nescafe in a little cup, and he signs 5 books for stock. There's nobody in the place to hear him speak. And so he's ready to leave, very humiliated, and he sees one person, and the one person's an old man who says, I'm here, you have to read. And he says, but you're alone, we cancel the event. No, if I'm here, you cannot cancel the event. I am the audience. Okay, he says, so he reads the piece. Gets up in his car, goes to the next town. Again, another bookstore, same situation, and the same old guy is sitting there. And he says, you have to read. And the guy says, but you heard me before, you have to read. So he reads again, goes to another town. This goes on forever until he ends up in Seattle or someplace like that. So he's crossing the United States in his car with no money, humiliated, alone. Nobody reads his books anymore. No one remembers him. And he has only one reader who follows him in his car. And so wherever he goes, the reader sits in front of him. It has a beautiful ending, but the story reminded me of my future. That's what's going to happen to me. So I'm very humble about the writing process, very humble, because these things peak and then nobody remembers them. Well, I'll take 2 more questions. No, 1 more question. Yeah, over there. Make it good.
Right? It's actually a writing process question. I was wondering how much of your first draft ends up in your final draft and what your revision process is like.
I could have answered that question before having a computer. But today with a computer, you keep correcting as you write. So how many drafts are there? I have no idea, but I'm sure that I write every paragraph more than two or three times. So, but I never have a first draft and a final draft. I don't save any of the stuff that I throw away. Why would I save it? And the correcting process for me is when I print it. When the story is told to the very end and I'm satisfied, more or less satisfied, then I print it and I read it on paper. And on paper, it's different. It's another story. And then I know what the story is about, the parts that are repeated, the parts that shouldn't be there, the parts that need to be highlighted, paragraphs that are dull. I see it in the printed page. And if I have doubts, I read it aloud. And if I still have doubts, I take it out. So that's my correcting process. And then it goes to Spain, to my agent. And I'm sure that nobody reads it over there because nobody has ever made a comment. Ever. No one has said, I don't know, take this out or put something. Nothing. The only time that I got a call years ago in Venezuela from a guy who was printing Eva Luna. He was printing the book. He was a printer. And at night, and he called me and he said, I read your book. And I'm sorry, but here you have a sentence, you try to make a joke here and you ruin the page. That's the only time I have had some editing in my life. Well, except my mother who never likes anything. But by the time my American editor gets the book, it has already been translated to several languages, so she can't change anything. So it's a very lonely process, very lonely. Well, you've been a wonderful audience. And I have to stop because they are going to kick us out, and I will sign everything you've got. But remember, no personalizing. Los latinos, por favor, solo la firma. Nada de dedicatorias para mi abuelita en el día de su cumpleaños. Nada, okay? Thank you so much. So much. Thank you.